If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Nothing like a little murder mystery to spice up your day. You're tuned in to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
I'm Tony Bruschi, and welcome to Hidden Killers. Today, we step into the courtroom to break down some new key testimony in the Richard Allen trial, where chilling details and new revelations are taking shape. The question that haunts us all, what really happened to Abby and Libby on that fateful day at the Monongahela Bridge? In today's session, the court heard the full, uncut 43-second video capturing the last moments of two young lives. And at the heart of it, a faint but unmistakable command. Guys down the hill. Witnesses took the stand describing eerie encounters with a man in dark layers, walking with purpose, refusing to engage a shadow of suspicion. But with every new piece of evidence, more questions arise. Was this the same man we know as Bridge Guy? And if so, can we truly tie him to Richard Allen? Today's testimony digs deeper than ever, forcing us to confront unsettling truths about memory, fear, and evidence that remains just out of reach. But one question lingers. How does this all connect? What drives someone to commit an act like this? And are we any closer to knowing the real motive behind these murders? Stay with us as we unravel the latest twists in this harrowing case. The courtroom sat in tense silence as the much-anticipated 43-second video from Libby German's phone was played, giving the jury and the world its first complete look at the infamous Bridge Guy moment. This video, long discussed in fragmented reports, had now been enhanced with clearer audio, revealing the faint, haunting command, "Guys down the hill." The enhanced footage confirmed that this moment happened as Abby Williams and Libby German reached the far end of the Monongahela Bridge, a dead end where the land transitions from public trails to private property, leaving them cornered. The video shows Abby walking just ahead, her voice softly stating, "There's no path." The camera, clearly being held by Libby, wavers and tilts towards the ground, pointing briefly at gravel. This subtle detail hints that Libby may have tried to conceal that she was filming, possibly fearing the intentions of the man approaching them. Just before the video cuts off, a figure identified as the alleged Bridge Guy appears for a split second in the frame. Though the visual is brief and unclear, the audio, now enhanced, delivers the ominous phrase that has haunted the investigation for years. The prosecution leaned into this moment heavily. The timestamp on the video, 2:13 p.m., February 13th, aligns chillingly with the day's events. This precise timestamp underscores the urgency of the timeline, capturing the last moments when the girls were alive. With the man's voice faintly commanding them to head down the hill, the prosecution painted a vivid picture. The girls had reached the bridge's far side only to realize they were trapped with no escape route. Testimonies from key witnesses took the jury deeper into the timeline. The first witness, 16-year-old Riley Garrison, described her walk on the Monongahela Bridge trails earlier that same day. Accompanied by her younger sisters and a friend, she recalled the serenity of the trail and one unsettling encounter. Garrison testified that she passed a man on the trail who caught her attention, not because of anything obvious, but because of his strange demeanor. She greeted him with a polite "hi," a common gesture among locals on the trails. But instead of a courteous reply, the man glared at her in silence, sending an uneasy chill down her spine. Riley's friend, Bree Wilbur, corroborated this account, describing the man as wearing many layers and walking with purpose, a phrase she repeated several times. Wilbur also noted that shortly after their encounter, she received a message from Libby on Snapchat asking if they were still at the bridge, hinting at a potential overlap with the girl's final moments. The prosecution emphasized these witness testimonies, arguing that the man they encountered on the trail was the same person captured in the video, now dubbed Bridge Guy. However, the defense was quick to challenge these recollections, pointing out inconsistencies in the descriptions. Both Garrison and Wilbur initially described the man as being taller, around 5'10", which does not align with Richard Allen's reported height of 5'5". This discrepancy raised doubts about whether the man in the video and the man encountered by the witnesses could be the same person. The prosecution then shifted the narrative to the forensic evidence collected from the scene, focusing on the items found near the bodies of Abby and Libby. A black Nike shoe, Hollister jeans, and several personal items, including a pink sweatshirt and a gray hoodie, were among the items retrieved from the creek near the crime scene. Notably, a single unspent .40 caliber round was found between the two girls, a critical piece of evidence that prosecutors allege ties Richard Allen to the crime. However, the defense seized this moment to cast doubt on the prosecution's case. Defense attorney Rosie Baldwin interrogated the crime scene investigator, pressing him on the procedures used to collect evidence. Baldwin pointed out that some items, such as sticks used to conceal parts of the crime scene, were not collected until 2 days after the initial investigation. The delay, Baldwin argued, compromised the integrity of the evidence. "Would you agree," Baldwin asked, "that the delayed recovery of evidence could affect its reliability?" The prosecution objected to the phrasing, but the judge allowed Baldwin to rephrase, highlighting the defense's focus on potential flaws in the investigative process. Another critical moment in the forensic testimony involved the handling of the .40 caliber round. When questioned, the crime scene investigator admitted that he had no knowledge of any DNA analysis connecting the round to Richard Allen. This admission, coupled with the defense's argument that the bullet could have been dropped at the scene days or even weeks prior, raised significant questions about whether the unspent round could definitively link Allen to the murders. Digital forensics, the phone as a silent witness. Jeremy Chapman, a digital forensic expert, testified about the extraction of data from Libby German's phone. He detailed how the Indiana State Police used a specialized tool, Cellebrite, to retrieve the video and messages from the device. Chapman explained that advances in technology allowed them to re-extract data several times over the years, with each extraction revealing additional fragments of information. This included Snapchat messages exchanged between Libby and Bri Wilbur shortly before the girls encountered Bridge Guy on the bridge. The defense attempted to undermine the reliability of these digital extractions, suggesting that valuable data might have been lost during each attempt. Under cross-examination, Chapman acknowledged that while new data was recovered with each extraction, some data might have been overwritten or lost. "Every extraction carries a risk," he admitted, giving the defense a crucial point to argue that the phone data might not tell the full story. The defense zeroed in on the reliability of the witnesses' memories, particularly those who claimed to have seen Bridge Guy on the day of the murders. Baldwin pointed out that Garrison initially described the suspect as being in his early 30s with curly hair and a muscular build. These details, the defense argued, do not match Richard Allen's physical appearance, either now or at the time of the murders. When pressed on the accuracy of her original statement, Garrison admitted that her memory might have been influenced by seeing the police sketches of the suspect released after the crime. This line of questioning opened the door for the defense to introduce the controversial sketches into evidence, something the prosecution had fought to avoid. With the sketches now admissible, the defense aimed to demonstrate that the investigation had been marred by public confusion and shifting narratives about the suspect's appearance. The final segment of testimony focused on surveillance footage from a local store and Fitbit data from witness Betsy Blair. The store's surveillance video confirmed the movements of key witnesses, including Blair, who reported seeing a man matching the suspect's description on the bridge. Blair's Fitbit data further corroborated her testimony, showing that she had walked the trails multiple times on the day of the murders. Blair testified that she saw two young girls, later identified as Abby and Libby, walking towards the bridge. Shortly after, she encountered a man standing on one of the bridge platforms looking as if he were waiting for someone. "He wasn't looking at me," Blair said, "but it felt like he was expecting someone." The defense challenged Blair's recollection, noting that she described the man as being in his 20s or 30s with poofy hair, a detail that could complicate the prosecution's argument that Richard Allen, then in his 40s, was the person she saw. That the prosecution's case against Richard Allen rests not only on witness testimonies and forensic evidence, but also on the behavioral patterns and psychological theories that shape public perception and investigative strategies. In cases like this, understanding how trauma affects memory becomes crucial, especially when witness accounts are central to the investigation. Witnesses who testified described interactions with a man who seemed off, refusing social greetings and walking with a determined stride. Psychologically, such behaviors can align with traits often observed in individuals seeking to control or intimidate others. However, trauma can cloud memory, and subtle inconsistencies, such as varying descriptions of the suspect's height and appearance, are not uncommon. Stress can fragment recall, meaning witnesses might misremember key details or fill in gaps unconsciously. This complicates the task of building a coherent narrative around the day's events. Further complicating matters, the police's decision to release two distinct sketches of the suspect at different stages of the investigation introduced confusion. Studies in cognitive psychology suggest that exposure to these images could have altered witness memories, leading them to retroactively fit their recollections to the sketches. The defense is likely to exploit these inconsistencies to undermine the prosecution's argument that Richard Allen is the man known as Bridge Guy. Ultimately, the trial will hinge not only on evidence, but on the reliability of human memory, challenging jurors to reconcile conflicting accounts with the available forensic facts. So far in the Richard Allen trial, one question remains: how much can we truly trust the memories of those who took the stand today? From witness testimonies about eerie encounters on the trails to enhanced video footage revealing Bridge Guy, this case presents a complex web of evidence. But not all of it points directly to Richard Allen. And that is where things get murky. We heard Riley Garrison and her friends describe a man who seemed out of place, silent, bundled in layers, and walking with intent. But was this the same man caught in the infamous 43-second video? Or was it someone else entirely? The defense pounced on inconsistencies in the witnesses' descriptions, details like height and hair color, and argued that the sketches released to the public may have contaminated their memories. Are these inconsistencies just the product of trauma and the passage of time, or do they reflect deeper flaws in the investigation? Then there's the forensic evidence, or rather, the lack of it. The unspent .40-caliber round found between the girls is compelling, but the crime scene investigator admitted there's no direct DNA or ballistic evidence connecting it to Richard Allen, with the defense suggesting that this bullet could have been dropped days or weeks before. The prosecution's case hinges on circumstantial evidence. And as we know, circumstantial evidence can raise suspicion, but it doesn't always prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. The defense has laid the groundwork to argue that this investigation is plagued with doubt. In a small community like Delphi, where rumors and fear spread quickly, identifying the real suspect becomes even more complicated. Was the investigation too narrow? Did law enforcement grasp at the first lead that seemed to fit? And how do we balance the psychological impact of trauma on witnesses against the need for concrete evidence in the courtroom? What strikes me most is the isolation the girls must have felt in those final moments, trapped on the far side of the Monongahela Bridge with a stranger ordering them down the hill. No escape. No one to hear their cries. It's a scene so chilling that it's hard to fathom, and harder still to forget. But as heart-wrenching as it is, our justice system demands more than emotion. It demands proof. The burden now rests on the prosecution to make its case airtight. The defense is poised to raise doubt at every turn, pointing to flaws in the investigation and gaps in the evidence. And as the trial unfolds, jurors will have to ask themselves, is Richard Allen truly Bridge Guy? Or is there still more to uncover in this tragedy? I'm Tony Bruschi. If you want to stay up to date on this case and others we cover, be sure to hit that subscribe button and follow us.
In a world where the darkest secrets lie just beneath the surface.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence says otherwise.
Where hidden killers roam unnoticed in the shadows.
Well, I think you would definitely be looking at a blend of toxic, very bad narcissistic personality traits, and they will be vengeful and possibly resort to violence.
Join Tony Bruschi as he uncovers the truth behind the most chilling cases.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence clearly says otherwise.
Each episode, we dig deep into the minds of those who commit the unthinkable.
To your point on narcissism, he thinks in his own mind how witty he is.
Yeah.
But he lost that jury. I was done with him in 2 minutes.
From unsolved mysteries to infamous crimes.
Geez, you've just talked about how you taught yourself how to do everything under the sun. I bet you did a YouTube video, how to best kill somebody with a knife.
Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi takes you where few dare to go.
How does someone with such a dark secret go unnoticed for so long?
With multiple new episodes every single day.
We're not just telling stories, we're seeking justice.
Listen now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Granger understands that you go to great lengths and sometimes heights to ensure the power is always flowing, which is why you can count on Granger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRANGER, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.